From WIPR in Baltimore, I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Last night, the New England Patriots won one of the most exciting Super Bowls in history. Will any of the ads go down in history? Do Super Bowl ads even matter anymore? These days, lots of advertising comes to us surreptitiously, often so heavily disguised that we don't even know it is advertising sponsored by a corporate entity. Mara Einstein is a professor of media studies at Queens College in New York. Her latest book is called Black Ops Advertising, about why advertisers are becoming publishers, publishers are becoming advertisers, and how these blurred lines are influencing what we spend and where we spend it. Edward Boches from Boston University is a former partner at Mullen, a large ad firm who created several Super Bowl ads back in the day. They join me to shed light on the dark art of advertising. First, the news. Hi, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Welcome to Midday on this Super Bowl Monday. If you were rooting for the Pats last night, congratulations. We all want to think that we are not influenced by advertising. We need to think that we are smart enough and aware enough and hip enough to know when we're being sold something so that when it happens, we're savvy enough to view it with a healthy dollop of skepticism. But then we find ourselves tearing up at that cute kid or the adorable puppy or laughing hysterically at the 30-second cinematic masterpiece on our TV screen or smartphone that its creator has designed without any attempt at subterfuge to make us want this, to support that, to buy this instead of buying that. So as we once again experienced last night during the Super Bowl, we know when an ad is an ad. But what about when an ad doesn't look like or sound like or resemble advertising as we know it? It turns out that a lot of the time, the article or the documentary we're so compelled by is written, produced, and promulgated by corporations or other entities. They are bent on befriending us and building our trust so that over time, will be willing to buy whatever it is they're selling. In this golden age of fake news, welcome to the world of fake commercials, which are constantly and often ingeniously used to populate our screens and eventually our consciousness, or at least our subconscious. Today, we'll talk about the new era of advertising with two experts from the world of TV and major advertising agencies. They are both now teaching and writing books about this stuff. Mara Einstein is on the faculty of Queens College in New York. Her latest book is called Black Ops Advertising. Edward Boches is the former chief creative officer at Mullen, a large ad agency outside of Boston. He now teaches at Boston University. He has recently authored the fifth edition of Hey Whipple, Squeeze This, the classic guide to creating great ads. Between the two of them, Mara Einstein and Edward Boches have created ads for General Motors, Google, Timberland, Uncle Ben's, Monster.com, Miller Lite, and Dole Foods, just to name a few. Mara Einstein joins us from the Argo Studios in New York. Edward Boches is at the studios of WGBH in Boston. Welcome to you both. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you,
Thanks
Tom.
For having us.
So, Edward, let me start with you. Since it's the day after the Super Bowl, what was your take on the best ad in the game? By the way, as a resident of Boston for, I guess, your whole life, congratulations on the Pats win. And when you weren't watching the game and thrilling to that fourth quarter, what ad struck you as the most effective?
Well, a couple of things. One is I thought that Tide did a brilliant job of taking advantage of both you know, the characters who are Terry Bradshaw, characters who are involved in the game, but also taking humor to a level which we know Super Bowl viewers really care about. Kia was the number one ad according to the USA polls, and my favorite for humor was Tide. Although I have to say that 84 Lumber, the story of Mexican immigrants, was perhaps the most dramatic, emotional, and compelling, despite the fact that Fox refused to let them run the complete original ad on air, claiming that it was too political.
Right, of course.
But it did drive so many people to their website that the site crashed last night, and the spot today is getting remarkable reviews.
So that's probably really great news for the folks at 84 Lumber that it's driven them to the website, which is where they want them to be perhaps ultimately. Mara Einstein, how about you? What struck you as the most effective?
I think I would separate it into two parts. One, what grabbed me most and what I thought was most effective. I know a lot of people liked the Skittles ad, and what's great about the Skittles ad is it's something that people can look at and not have to hear what's going on. And that is particularly important because a lot of people are watching the Super Bowl when there's a big party going on and they don't have to shush everybody in the room so they can see it. In terms of my own personal appeal, what really appealed to me was the Audi ad about what do I say to my daughter. And I know online that got an awful lot of downvotes on YouTube, and it really shows a lot of the polarity that's going on in our society right now in terms of people's appeals. But I think, you know, it wasn't just Budweiser or 84 Lumber or, you know, even Coca-Cola pulled out the immigrant spot that they had run before. I think what's really interesting is how we viewed those this year, which is really tied to the political, you know, environment we find ourselves in, as opposed to a couple of years ago, we might have looked at that and said, oh, these are really sort of sappy ads to be running in the Super Bowl.
Eber Boches, do Super Bowl ads matter anymore? I mean, there's so many other ways that people are getting us and getting to us. Is a big, huge spend, especially for some of these smaller companies. I mean, there was Yellowfin Wine. Is that the name? Yellowtail Wine. You know, it seemed to blow, I would imagine, a good bit of its yearly ad budget on this one shot at the Super Bowl. Is that a good strategy for companies these days?
Well, there's not a simple, straightforward answer to that question. What's interesting is clearly Super Bowl advertising in any kind of broad reach frequency media buy is a little less dominant or perhaps important than it used to be, given fragmented media and all the other ways in which brands can reach consumers and the way in which all of us can find content. But what's interesting is this was a year where we saw products such as Tide, Febreze, Mr. Clean, very, very sort of mainstream brands that typically have not advertised on the Super Bowl because we think of them as being sort of targeted perhaps at women or the traditional homeowner kind of thing. And Procter & Gamble, for example, has spent an awful lot of money in recent years in digital and not buying big television. And they've concluded that the effectiveness of broad reach advertising where they can get scale and get it all at once and reach a more universal audience can only be achieved with something like the Super Bowl. So I think we're seeing it getting pulled in two directions. One is you've got to spread your content, which sort of leads into Mara's whole theory. You got to bring your content into a lot of other places, but there still seems to be value for something like the Super Bowl.
And Mara Einstein, you wrote about the Mr. Clean ad in particular in a blog post that you did for Oxford University Press, and I agree with you completely where you said that was the worst ad that was on last night. When I see this, you know, sexy piece of Mr. Clean animation making a woman hot and bothered because he's cleaning the house, I'm thinking, this is a woman who's never been to my house. And obviously any ad runs the risk of alienating a large sector of the buying public. If you're doing, I mean, they call it broadcasting for a reason. This is going out to everywhere. Do you think anybody hurt themselves last night?
Well, I was really confused about that ad, about who they were ultimately trying to appeal to, frankly, because, you know, maybe it brought, you know, people talk about the fact that sex sells. Well, sex doesn't sell. Sex gets people's attention. And so the beginning of that ad certainly got people's attention because maybe women were paying attention to the fact that there was this sort of sexy Mr. Clean run around, but certainly men were paying attention to the fact that this woman was getting all hot and bothered about the fact that somebody else was cleaning her house. And then, of course, at the end of the ad, Mr. Clean turns into her husband, and the whole idea is that, you know, the husband will get more attention from his wife if he starts cleaning the house, which is fine. But, I, given the construction of the ad, I wasn't really sure ultimately who that was trying to appeal to. It certainly didn't attract me to want to be using Mr. Clean. So that ad kind of fell flat for me.
Yeah. Tell us what you mean by the title of your book, Black Ops Advertising.
Black ops advertising parallels black ops when we think about it in terms of the military, which is any sort of covert operation. And for people who have worked in advertising and marketing, we talk about using objectives and strategies and tactics, which are very militaristic terms. We also talk in terms about the fact that the people that we're trying to reach are our target. And even your listeners, I'm sure, have heard that term, right? We're the target audience. And so the next obvious step in terms of moving along with advertising and marketing today, in the same way the military has moved from being on the field and approaching, so to advertising, instead of primarily using the sort of Super Bowl broad reach, very obvious kind of marketing that has traditionally been done, what advertisers are doing more and more is this advertising that we are not aware of.
And Edward Boches, there's a case study that you use when you teach at BU about a group in the Netherlands who was, and this is not a company, a corporation, but this is an advocacy organization that was putting out ads and well, not just ads, but maybe you could explain their approach to get people to change their minds about the issue of forced marriages. Tell us about that.
Well, there was there's an organization, yes, in Sweden who works a lot with trying to prevent forced childhood marriages. And you know, I think there's two sides of this whole content that isn't necessarily labeling itself overtly as advertising. And perhaps some of it can be done, as Mara says, as black ops, but with perhaps a attempting to trick the public in a negative way. But in other cases, it can be used, I think, for really, really positive approaches. So this was, in order to call attention to this issue, this organization created, they got a 12-year-old girl to start a blog about her impending wedding to a 35-year-old man, with nothing that would show or suggest that this was anything but an authentic blog in which she wrote about her fears, her concerns, her anxiety, her anticipation, etc. And it just got seeded on the web as a blog might, a little bit of Twitter coverage here and there, and over time, what happened was it started to go viral, but mostly brought viral by people who were critical of this and mortified that this was happening, subsequently picked up by a lot of European press and social justice advocates on Twitter. And then only eventually was it revealed that this was really an ad campaign designed to call attention to the organization's name was Plan, designed to call attention to this problem. And then it became a big, you know, sort of PR thing with a fake wedding, with a girl, Thea, walked out on her fiancé. Lots and lots of press coverage, lots and lots of, you know, YouTube videos, etc. So,
and at the time that the wedding took place, for example, the group Plan had already admitted or outed themselves about the fact that this was made up.
At a certain point, once this thing started to really build some traction, they basically revealed that they were behind the whole thing, and this was a campaign to call attention to this issue. And that helped accelerate attention and coverage even to a greater degree.
So, Mara Einstein, it sounds like the point of advertising used to be aggregate eyeballs. So the Super Bowl is a great way to aggregate eyeballs. You get more eyeballs for that than almost anything else. And then you basically guess that the people watching are the people you want to reach. But now it sounds like the point isn't that necessarily. It's to make ads that somehow get disseminated in other ways.
Right. Well, the issue has been, and part of the reason why the ads have become covert is because we've become so successful at avoiding advertising in all of the formats in which it appears, or a lot of people have. So it started with the remote control on television and then the DVR. So we were able to avoid watching commercials. And then in the online space, and particularly now, more and more people are starting to use ad blockers. And so advertisers are having to try and find a way to get around the ad blockers. And the way to do that is to make the advertising not look like advertising, and then it circumvents the ad blocking. And what happens online, as probably most people know, is because of data and cookies, we're followed around the internet. And so the advertising can be directed to us specifically for the things that we are most interested in based on the things that we have been doing online. And because of that, advertisers can really specialize what the messages are that are being sent to us. Now, the expectation and the hope of advertisers and the kind of creative they want to produce are things that are going to generate very strong emotions in us, because those are the things we are most likely to pass on through social media. And with therefore, we become the mechanism through which these messages become disseminated to our friends and family.
Who needs Fox Network when we got us? That's interesting. Mm-hmm. All right, we're talking ads today here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, more discussion of the media landscape, the challenges and responsibility of journalists who are covering President Trump. Lewis Wallace is a transgender reporter who worked for Marketplace on public radio. He published a piece on the website Medium.com called "Objectivity is Dead, and I'm Okay with It." When he refused to take it down, he was fired by Marketplace. He'll join me to talk about how to cover a president who, during the campaign and in the first few weeks of his administration, has shown an alarming propensity for saying things that are not even remotely true. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. Today, my guests are Edward Boches, who teaches advertising strategy and creative at Boston University. His latest book is Hey Whipple, Squeeze This, the classic guide to creating great ads. Dr. Mara Einstein is professor of media studies at Queens College at the City University of New York. She's the author of Black Ops Advertising. What was your favorite Super Bowl ad last night? You are welcome to join our conversation when we come back from a break. 410-662-8780 is the number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Glad you're with us. Stay around.
This is your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR, where you're tuned to Midday.
You don't look like you're from around here.
I want to brew a beer.
Welcome to America.
You're not wanted here. Go back home.
Welcome to St. Louis, son.
Beer for my friend, please.
Thank you. But next time, this is the beer we drink.
Eberhard Anheuser.
Dolphus Busch.
That was the Budweiser ad that ran during last night's Super Bowl game, a dramatic montage of company co-founder Adolphus Busch's arduous immigration from Germany to America in 1857. The ad shows an anti-immigrant crowd jeering Busch as he first disembarks in the United States. And it goes on to depict his chance meeting at a pub with his eventual brewing partner, Eberhard Anheuser. The 60-second ad closes with a banner that says, "When nothing stops your dreams, this is the beer we drink." If you're just joining us today, my guests are Dr. Mara Einstein of Queens College in New York, whose latest book is called Black Ops Advertising, and Edward Boches, who teaches advertising at Boston University. His latest book is called Hey Whipple, Squeeze This, the classic guide to creating great ads. So what about you? Do you think you're savvy enough to know when advertisers are making a pitch? And if you do know, can you distance yourself enough so that you won't be seduced into doing what they want you to do? You are welcome to join our conversation here on Midday. 410-662-8780, our email address, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle if you want to drop us a tweet, @MiddayTomHall. Mara Einstein, you write in your book, Black Ops Advertising, something that surprised me a bit, and that is the people who are embedding ads in formats that don't immediately look like ads. And you say in your book, by the way, that only about 8% of us are able to discern whether or not it's an ad or not. So the vast majority of us are just not hip enough to know when we're getting solicited. But it's not just these sort of scuzzy, you know, off-center websites. I mean, it's places like the National Geographic or the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times. How has that happened? What forms do those things take?
Well, they look like any article that you would read on in any of those publications. So probably the most famous ad in the New York Times was the first one they did. And this is what's known as customized native advertising. And what it is an ad that looks exactly like an article. There's a picture on the top. There's a byline, meaning that there's a quote-unquote journalist's name attached to it, which is not something we would expect to see in an ad. This had video in it and very long copy that looked like what you would expect to read in a regular article in the New York Times. What is particularly concerning about these kinds of ads is that they are written typically by former journalists. When a number of newspapers folded in the United States over the last decade, a lot of journalists found themselves out of a job. And the places where they've been able to find employment is in these places that are producing advertising for these more traditional journalistic outlets. And so the first ad was in the New York Times was for a story about women in prison. And it happened to be one that was paid for by Netflix, which was an ad for their third season of Orange is the New Black. Now, you know, that in and of itself is fairly innocuous, and I wouldn't say every version of native advertising is a terrible thing, but we have to start questioning when companies like Goldman Sachs are paying for this kind of advertising in the New York Times, or Shell Oil is writing a story about environmentalism in the New York Times, and we don't understand that there's an oil company trying to present their particular point of view about what the best way to be sustainable is. That's where these things start to be pretty insidious. And it doesn't just happen there. It's, you know, probably the most famous website as it relates to native advertising is BuzzFeed. And BuzzFeed sustains itself on native advertising. And what makes it, and native advertising by definition, is indigenous to the site in which it exists. So it's created to look just like the site. So something like BuzzFeed produces its own advertising, so they know how to create it so it looks like everything else on the site. So a number of people may have done quizzes from BuzzFeed, you know, which one of these Fraggle Rock characters are you? Or they have listicles, you know, what are the nine things that have changed in the last 20 years? And then you get to the eighth thing on the list and find out this list happens to be an ad for a cell phone, right? And so you've spent all your time interacting with this information only to find out it's there because somebody's trying to sell you something.
And BuzzFeed, of course, which was very much in the news for its very controversial decision, its journalistic decision to publish the dossier that had been assembled about Donald Trump, a dossier that had not been able to be verified, confirmed, or backed up by a number of different news sources who had it in their possession for several weeks before the election. Interesting that you write in your book that it's listed on this organization called Hoover's as an advertising agency, BuzzFeed. Mm-hmm. It's not listed as a media publication. It's an advertising agency. Edward Boches, for example, in the case of this Budweiser ad that we just heard, when we talk about targeting people, it's important to know that the folks who design that ad are not just producing that ad for the people who may drink beer, right? Their audience, their intended audience, actually even goes further than that. Isn't that the case?
Well, I think absolutely. I mean, these days, I think the majority of brands in their advertising aren't trying to overtly sell you anything. They're trying to become part of a cultural conversation. They're trying to provide you with content that you might find useful or meaningful, and then in return, think positively about the brand, to have them top of mind and look them up on the web, or just feel good about them if they're in a category where you're going to buy something. I think a Super Bowl advertising, first of all, is a category all, you know, unto itself, because every brand who is doing something on the Super Bowl isn't just talking to prospective customers. They're talking to their distributors. They're talking to their employees. They're talking to stockholders and all of their constituents and just trying to make themselves appear to be important, part of pop culture with a relevant message and perhaps to convey beliefs more than sell virtues of a particular product. I think in the case of some of I think these things are very much intertwined. I mean, we live in a world now, or advertisers, marketers live in a world where they no longer can only rely on paid media because there's a proliferation of media. We seek out our own niche interests. We have diminished attention spans. So marketers are forced to become creators of their own content and then try to do things that will earn attention. And some of the native content is a perfect example of that. I think that it's easy to label all native content as bad or terrible or attempting to try to trick the public, and I don't think that's the case at all. And in fact, the Orange is the New Black piece was stupendous. It really was all about what prison conditions are like for women in America, number one. Number two, it was clearly labeled as sponsored by Netflix. It was labeled that way on the article, and it was labeled that way at the bottom of the New York Times online, where it says content from our advertisers. And Netflix didn't try to conceal that at all. I mean, they even promoted and announced that this was branded content they were creating. And the purpose may have been to get you more interested in Orange is the New Black, but was also to try to provide some useful, meaningful information that might keep that conversation going. So I think there's two sides to this, and I would be reluctant to suggest that all native advertising is quote-unquote black ops.
Edward Boches used to run a big advertising agency outside of Boston called Mullen. He teaches now advertising practice at Boston University. He joins us from WGBH in Boston. Dr. Mara Einstein teaches at Queens College in New York. Her latest book is called Black Ops Advertising. She came to the world of academia through the world of television, including places like MTV. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Our phone number here on the program, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle at Midday Tom Hall. Let's go to the phones. Ellen in Owings Mills, welcome to Midday with Edward Boches and Mara Einstein.
Hi. I called because I was thinking when you were talking about aggregating eyeballs, I have a relative who works at one of the big talent agencies in Hollywood. They started a digital department a few years ago, and what they do is they sign people they call influencers. Mostly, they seem to be in their teens and 20s. They have huge followings on platforms like YouTube and Instagram. Like you might have a young woman who posts pictures of herself in a bikini and has 1.5 million followers. And they get these people deals with brands. So, you know, or a girl who is doing YouTube videos on makeup tips, and they'll get her a deal with a makeup, and she'll be using that makeup on her video. And people are posing with snack products, sunglasses, you name it.
Thank you for the call, Ellen. And Mayor Einstein, you write about this in your book, and you also say that about 91% of the information that we get about various brands comes from face-to-face conversations conversations we have on the phone, not on the internet. Mm-hmm. That was very surprising to me. So this sharing stuff and this getting people to start a conversation about it couldn't be more important to folks who are trying to sell us stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, because this is what we were talking about earlier in terms of social media. The way information gets disseminated through social media is through these influencers. And influencers can either be some of the people who have made themselves famous through YouTube and so on, and certainly in the cosmetic area and the beauty area, there have been some big stars created in that space. But we're also talking about celebrities here. And one of them who's gotten into trouble for this, for instance, has been Kim Kardashian. And so the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, has actually come after her to say, you know, if you're getting paid for these tweets or you're getting paid for information on Instagram, you need to label these in some way so people know that you are being paid for this content. Now, you know, I think people are probably smart enough if she's holding a bottle of pills to understand that she probably got paid for it, but it really is required to be labeled. And, you know, in the case of someone like Kardashian, she has an awful lot of young followers. And so they may not be as aware of the fact that this is advertising. And certainly there was an even more recent study that's come out since my book came out out of Stanford that showed that junior high school students are not aware that this is this has a sponsor behind it. And to the point that was made earlier, I agree. I don't think all native advertising is somehow terrible. The issue is, and the reason why I wrote the book, is to help people to see when they are engaging with native advertising and sponsored content. And part of that is that even though it's labeled with Netflix, even though it says paid post in the URL for the New York Times and so on, people don't see it. They don't know to look for it. And because we're used to advertising being in a certain sort of format, we expect that that's the way it's going to always be. And so when it's changed in the online space so that we see ads in the middle of our news feed or ads on the New York Times or the Washington Post and so on, that we know to say, is this really an ad or is this journalistic content? And just to be a little bit more alert to the fact that it may have a sponsor behind it.
My daughter, who's now in her late 20s, but whom Edward has known since she was a little girl, she saw her first commercial television when she was 4 years old. We were visiting some friends for Thanksgiving in upstate New York. We were in a different room than she was. She was watching television. And she came into me with her eyes popping out of her head. And she says, "Daddy, there are Barbies on TV and you can buy them." She was just so shocked, amazed, astounded at the fact that you could purchase Barbies on TV. There is, Edward Boches, Barbie.com. There is HappyMeal.com. The companies are starting to go to their potential customers at a very young age. You write in your book about the importance of authenticity. And I wonder, how do advertisers and marketers get over the hurdles of authenticity when we are, you know, deluged with so many people who then quite quickly turn out to be inauthentic and lying?
That's a good question. You know, I've spent my career trying to do good work and work that matters for brands that I believe in. So my whole approach to this is to start with, oh, we're not trying to deceive anybody or conceal anything, and the truth is the best thing to convey in advertising. It's especially true today when we do have social media and any brand can be called out immediately. I have to confess that I have not done a lot of research on how much consumers do and don't know what content is attempting to sell them under the radar. But, you know, I think of something like American Idol when all of the reviewers would sit there with the cans of Coke on the table in front of them. And
good old-fashioned product placement, huh?
Yeah, and I don't think there's anybody who would look at that and not know that someone's paying a lot of money for those cans of Coke to sit there. It strikes me that consumers and prospective customers they're pretty smart. And these days, they're more media savvy than they've ever been. And I would be really concerned, you know, when it has something to do with perhaps with medicine or financial services or places where a bad decision mm-hmm. could have significant consequences on somebody's life. But I think in the cases of most brands, it isn't. I'm surprised if Mara has found that it really is all that invisible, because the consumers that I talk to, whether it's in focus groups, whether it is in research, whether it's students who aren't necessarily advertising students, people are pretty savvy these days, more so than they used to be a generation or two ago.
Mara, make a quick comment about that. Then we got to take a break and we'll come back.
Well, the example that I start the book with, which is Red Bull and the guy jumping out of outer space, you know, now a lot of people know that that was Red Bull paying for the space launch. But the fact that the guy jumping from outer space, the fact of the matter is 4 years ago when it happened, it was a leaked story on the news and nobody talked about the fact that that was an ad for Red Bull.
Dr. Mara.
But that ran, that was a live broadcast on Red Bull's YouTube channel where the majority of people watched it on the Red Bull YouTube channel.
But and not when they watched it on the CBS Evening News. I mean,
right.
You know. They,
well, then that's
yeah.
the problem of that's the problem of the CBS Evening News.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They should be doing their due diligence.
Dr. Mara Einstein teaches media studies at Queens College in New York. She's the author of Black Ops Advertising. Edward Boches teaches the practice of advertising at Boston University. He's the author of Hey Whipple, Squeeze This, the classic guide to creating great ads. You are welcome to be the author of a tweet or an email or a phone call, 410-662-8780, our email address midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. Before we take a break, on Mondays, it's our practice here on Midday to acknowledge by name the people who have been murdered in the city of Baltimore. We are indebted to the Baltimore Sun and Ellen Worthing. She's been compiling a list of Baltimore homicide victims for the past 16 years. Baltimore suffered its deadliest January in more than a decade. We recorded 32 homicides last month, the most in January since 2005, when there were also 32. The only year on record with more killings in the month of January is 1973, when there were 35 homicides. So far this year, our city has already lost 39 people to homicide. 9 people died in violence in Baltimore last week. We stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. They are Donnell Delbridge, age 25, Marius Smith Jr., age 31, Darrell Webb, age 22, a man age 21 whom police have yet to identify, Donald Simpton, age 20, Jesse Worthen, age 53, Tanya Chadwick, age 20, Lawrence Jones, age 25, and James Hendricks. He was 24 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday here on your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
How can we be a secret society if we can't keep all of our secrets?
Do they know we faked the moon landing?
No, not yet.
Or that there are only 49 shades of gray?
They're suspicious, but that's not what I'm talking about.
Did they figure out we deflated the football?
No, we found a fall guy for that one. What they do know is that avocados from Mexico have good fats.
So they know they're healthy.
They know everything. Kyle, are you streaming this?
Is that not cool?
No, it's not cool. That's what secret means. It's a secret society.
Oh, wow. Secret, yep, yep. At least they don't know about subliminal advertising.
That's not even a thing, right?
Eat them!
What the?
Avocados from Mexico.
All right, on Midday here, those are the folks trying to sell you avocados from Mexico. It ran during last night's Super Bowl game. There's this robe leader of the secret society complaining that their big secret has gotten out. That secret, of course, is that avocados from Mexico are nutritious. So here we have an example of an ad that's satirizing fake news and conspiracy theories. It even has a wink and a nod to Deflategate with the game's most valuable player, Tom Brady. And at the very end, there's this really quick flash of the actor John Lovett, who says, "Eat them," the subliminal advertising coming through in that very funny ad, I thought, for avocados from Mexico. If you've just joined us, I'm Tom Hall. We're talking about the art of advertising and advocating and how marketers penetrate the very thick haze of media messages to wiggle their way onto our radar screens, or at least onto our TV and smartphone and computer screens. Edward Bochus joins us from Boston. He's a former creative director of a major ad agency. He teaches the practice of advertising at Boston University. Dr. Mara Einstein joins us from New York. She's a professor of media studies at Queens College in New York. You are welcome to join our conversation. 410-662-8780 is our phone number, our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Edward Bochus, there's an example of advertisers sort of, you know, spoofing themselves, I mean, making fun of advertising. Does that work? Does that get folks to say, oh, avocados, they're okay, I can eat them after all, because they've had a good laugh and they've seen that the company doesn't appear to take itself too seriously? Is that, I mean, if you were in a meeting with the people paying for that ad, is that what you'd be convincing them would happen in this particular spot?
I think advertising thinks it's so important that it actually satirizes itself quite often, as if everybody would get the joke. But again, I think inherent in that is there's an assumption that viewers do understand media and advertising enough to get the subliminal advertising thing and all of the other contemporary subjects that they're tapping into. And in the Super Bowl, I think there's a lot of criteria that any brand advertiser is using. Certainly there's the reach frequency, certainly there's the likely effectiveness of the ad, but people actually pay attention to the ratings on things like Brand Bowl or the USA Ad Meter. And so in many cases, they're just trying to be the funniest or among the top 10 funny or well-liked ads on the Super Bowl. And they often are really sort of different evaluation criteria than it might be if they're planning a long-term media buy that's going to run for a certain number of months and is going to be more specifically targeted at who's identified as as the prospective customer.
And Mara Einstein, you're right that scientists have studied what our attention spans are in what's been known as the attention economy, meaning that one of the great currencies is our time and attention. You say that folks have figured out that the average attention span is 8 seconds and that that's less than a goldfish.
Yeah.
That is comforting, I'll tell you.
Well, think about it when you go online, and if some page doesn't load fast enough, you're on to the next thing faster than you can bat an eye, you know. One of the things I wanted to hopefully we could touch on by the end of this conversation, we are getting sort of there, is, you know, where the money is going in terms of advertising. And I wonder if Edward also has a comment about this. And what's happening is, you know, except for big events like the Super Bowl, most of the money is starting to move out of the traditional advertising places like radio, like newspapers, like television, and moving onto the digital space. And most of the money in the digital space is going to two companies, which is Google and Facebook. And if you think about Google and Facebook, those are two companies that are producing absolutely no content. And so, you know, what's happening is that the underlying economic system that has been supporting the media is starting to implode. And this is a conversation that's been bubbling up in the media and advertising arena for a long time, but nobody seems to really be having an idea of what is going to sustain us. The only person that I've heard of that's talked about it at all is Barry Diller. And that was at an industry event. But I'm sure your listeners are already starting to feel that in order to be able to get the kind of content that they want, they're having to pay for it out of their own pocket. Because there's really two ways to pay for content. You either watch advertising or you subscribe to it. So you're paying for HBO Go, you're paying for Hulu, Netflix, Showtime, whatever it is. And all of that starts to add up over time. And so the concern from sort of a bird's eye view, a big picture view of all of this begins to become, you know, a not a digital divide, but an information divide. And who can afford and who cannot afford to be able to have access to content because we're no longer willing to engage with advertising.
And Edward Boches, I mean, Facebook, for example, there is a big movement to get Facebook to install a dislike button next to the like button. And they danced around about that. Mara writes about this in her book. And they came up with other options, but they didn't want to do a dislike button because that's anti-advertising. I mean, the fact that just recently, within the last couple of years, the tide has switched and more money was spent on digital than spent on traditional advertising. What do you think this portends looking forward 5 years, 10 years, 20 years?
Well, I think it's interesting. First of all, television doesn't seem to be getting hurt at all. I mean, the money going into television continues to grow as it does in digital. It's the other traditional media, radio, print, newspapers, magazines that are all losing out. And you can look at one of the perfect examples, which is the New York Times, which is very, very aggressively moving to a pay-for-content model and becoming less and less dependent on advertising, both offline and online. But I think, as Mara said, my gosh, I mean, I'm paying for Spotify, for Squarespace, for Netflix, for Hulu, for, you know, premium cable shows, YouTube Red if I want to avoid advertising on YouTube. And that is going to get prohibitive very quickly for just about anybody. So I think the advertising model is not going away anytime soon. And again, if you look at this from the perspective of smart brands, I mean, I started a social media business at Mullen before I left, and we did mostly earned content, but we did some paid content. But we tried to embrace a level of respect for you know, any of our readers or viewers, with the idea that we're not going to go into these places with stuff that's going to interrupt or appear that we're shoving a message down people's throats. It becomes the responsibility of brands to provide useful, meaningful, entertaining, beautiful content. I realize that's still a minority of brands and marketers mm-hmm. who have embraced that way of thinking, but I think the tide will continue to go in that direction.
Yeah, because interesting. The onus is on the producers of the products, not the producers of who are publishing material that you know, alleged potential customers of those products might want to read. Obviously, if you're putting an ad in the New York Times, you have a certain assumption about the education level and the, you know, political engagement by people who are reading that publication. Now you're saying it's up to Tide and Procter & Gamble and everybody to make the content interesting on their own.
Right, because we have enough ways to opt out. I don't know anybody who doesn't know exactly where that skip this ad button is on any pre-roll
right.
that they ever encounter. It's the first thing you look for. So, you know, I think we're starting to see, not quite enough. My students ask me all the time, hey, how come all we ever look at in class is good advertising, funny advertising, provocative and meaningful advertising? How come what we see in the world is also terrible.
Mm, interesting. We are running out of time, and I want to try to get to at least one more call. Bill in Bel Air, welcome to Midday with Mara Einstein and Edward Boches.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I mean, I have a small business, spent tens of thousands of dollars of my own money over the past 4 years developing a patent, developing a product. I've got a bachelor's degree in marketing. And advertising is just prohibitively expensive. I can't find anything, and I'm on Instagram and whatever, can't find any way to get my message out cost effectively.
Okay, well, Bill, we're running out of time, so let me just throw that to Mara as our last comment here. We just have about 15 seconds left. I mean, is the Internet going to cut down the cost of advertising for small business owners like Bill?
Well, you know, that was the expectation. The issue is while everybody can have a megaphone, everybody's megaphone is not the same size. Yeah. And that was the expectation of what was going to happen online. And unfortunately, Bill is caught in a situation of not being able to get the same kind of message or megaphone out there that some of the larger advertisers are.
And we're going to have to make that the last word. Mara Einstein and Edward Boches, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
Mara Einstein's latest book is called Black Ops Advertising. Edward Boches is the author of Hey Whipple, Squeeze This, the classic guide to creating great ads. He's joined us today from WGBH in Boston. Mara's been on the line with us from Argo Studios in Manhattan. We've got links to both of their books on our website, wypr.org/. Midday. That's it for us today. I'd like to thank the Diz for providing lunch. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. Full disclosure, they give us the lunch and we mention their product. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknall. The show is produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Charlie Hines provides production assistance. Thanks for listening to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you've been with us. Have a great day.